Hey, everyone. Thought you might like to know, to begin today, how all the members of Congress in our area voted on the debt ceiling bill. So here goes. Among the senators, Chuck Schumer, Joe Lieberman, and Richard Blumenthal all voted yes. Menendez, Lautenberg, and Kirsten Gillibrand all voted no. Now, Gillibrand's vote made some news as she dug in with the more liberal bloc, who complained of no new taxes on the wealthiest Americans in the deal, no shared sacrifice. The Times headline on this today says, Gillibrand breaks with party to vote against debt bill. That might be a little strong, since so many Democrats were unhappy with the deal. But technically, she did break with President Obama and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid with her no vote. And, of course, she's up for re-election next year, so that may have been behind that calculation. In the House, all the New Jersey members of both parties voted yes, except Republican Scott Garrett, who thought it didn't cut spending enough. There will be still more debt in 10 years, if this is all that gets passed, than there is today. So Garrett voted no for that reason. Everybody else voted yes in New Jersey. In New York, most of the downstate Democrats voted no. The only yes votes were from Tim Bishop, Steve Israel, and Carolyn McCarthy on Long Island, Nita Lowey in Westchester and the Bronx, and Greg Meeks from Queens. Again, all the other downstate Democrats voted, like Senator Gillibrand, against the debt ceiling deal. Downstate Republicans, Peter King and Nan Hayworth and Michael Grimm, all voted yes. And in Connecticut, Courtney and Himes voted yes. DeLauro, Larson, and Murphy voted no. So that's your tri-state roll call on the debt ceiling bill, in case it matters to your vote the next time they're up for re-election. It's easy. REM's leaving New York, and a new crunching of census data finds about 1.6 million people left the Empire State during the last 10 years, while immigration from other countries was down 25% compared with the 1990s. The total population still grew because of more births than deaths and immigration that is still robust. But the Empire Center for New York State Policy, part of the conservative Manhattan Institute think tank, puts this in the context of the last 50 years of migration and concludes that more than 7 million people have left New York State, while almost 5 million people have come from other countries since the year 1960. What does it mean? What do the last 10-year stats mean? We'll take calls shortly about your own comings and goings in the last decade. With me are E.J. McMahon, director of the Empire Center and co-author of this report, and Sam Roberts, New York Times urban affairs correspondent, who reports frequently on census data and demographics. Hey, E.J. Hi, Sam.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
E.J., those 50-year numbers are really interesting, and they're very specific, and I want you to break it down for us because they seem to be on two different measures. You have 4.8 million foreign country immigrants and 7.3 million New Yorkers moving out to other parts of this country. So why do you compare it that way, and what's important there?
Well, I think that net migration, which is the sum of those two numbers, is probably the best barometer we have of New York's attractiveness, not just to people in the rest of the United States, but to people all over the world. And we all know how important foreign immigration has been to New York and to New York City in particular. What's interesting is if you go back 50 years, the 1960s was the last decade that New York was actually somewhat positive on that net migration number, where we actually took in where more people arrived here than left here. Then immigration picks up, as it did nationwide, after the 1965 federal immigration bill. And we have a fairly steady flow of foreign immigrants through the next several decades, and it peaks in the 1990s. And it's a nice, steady flow of people. But if you look on the downside of it, and we have a chart in our report that shows this fairly dramatically, if you look in the 70s, in particular, New York State endures like a demographic catastrophe. Our domestic migration loss that is the number of New Yorkers moving to the rest of the country, goes over 2 million. It was actually 2.4 million in the 1970s. And that kind of parallels our loss of jobs in the 1970s and, of course, the city's fiscal crisis.
Fiscal crisis, crime rates were so high.
Right.
Anybody who could move out, especially, which tended to be more middle-class people, tended to move out.
Right. But it wasn't just the suburbanization trend to, you know, Long Island or the northern suburbs. It was out completely, out to New Jersey, out to places beyond Jersey. It levels off again since 1980. We've had a fairly steady flow to other states. It was 1.5 million in the 80s, 1.3 million in the 90s. All the indicators improve in the 90s on net. And then in the last 10 years, we kind of regress again, so that our average net migration per year was about 68,000 people in the 2000s. And it seems that no matter how good things get or how much better they get, we still haven't crossed the line where we are attracting more people than we lose.
If, just so I'm clear on the numbers, if you're measuring attractiveness of New York as a place to live or to come to, did you include migrants to New York from other parts of this country? Because, of course,
yes.
New York still draws in the young and ambitious in finance and the arts and other things. So then how close to balance is it in the last decade?
Well, if you look, that's what you're talking about is the measure known as domestic migration, which is people in from other states and people out to other states.
Right.
New York, there's no question, and all the data and everything we observe shows that New York City in particular attracts lots of young people in the way you describe. But it also loses a lot of people, typically, you know, middle-aged people, people starting families. And actually, if on that domestic migration number, on balance just to other states, without counting foreign immigrants, we've been losing people for a long time. I mean, the city in particular has been a loser to domestic migration. It's been the foreign immigration that's been canceling out or balancing out a lot of that.
Sam Roberts, as a census and demographics watcher, did you read the Empire Center report? And what do you make of it as a judgment on New York and things we may need to change?
I did read it and actually wrote about it too, Brian, and it's kind of fascinating. One of the things, I think there are a couple of things you need to put it in perspective. One, that we've always had churning in our population. People are always coming and going, particularly in New York City. I think it's also important to look at who these people are, and I'm sure EJ has done that or will do more of a follow-up on that. So are we gaining people who are more likely to succeed here, to make a living here, to make their fortunes here, however we describe that, and losing people who are more of retirement age, more people who are about to raise a family and find that it's easier to do that in the suburbs or other states, or at least has been traditionally. And then another thing that I think is worth looking at, particularly given the source of this report, you know, an arm of the Manhattan Institute, is why we have had so much of a net loss of particularly domestic migration in the past 10 years. These are 10 years, for the most part, when we've had Republican mayors in New York City and, to a great extent, Republican governors of New York State under Governor Pataki in the late 90s and the early part of this decade. So what is it about public policy, if anything, that has driven people out?
EJ, you want to take a crack at that?
First of all, I agree very much with Sam that New York has long been known for that churn that he referred to, people coming in, staying here for a few years, and then going somewhere else. So I should point out that a lot of the foreign immigrants who come here, the numbers tend to show, also are among the people who then move to other states after a period of time. Or there's also the churn and the flow through the city from one borough to another as people's circumstances improve. I also agree we're going to be doing follow-ups on the nature of migration and how it's changed over the decades. On policy, as you know, the data is agnostic on policy. The data show what they show. I think that it's clear that there's something we're getting wrong on policy or some set of things. What those things are, we can discuss, and we can surmise, you know, there's some econometric studies that point to some aspects. If you believe that jobs, that people follow jobs, and the literature tends to be divided on how much is responsible on the economic side, how much job loss is responsible for population loss. But for instance, New York City lost a tremendous number of jobs in the 1970s, led by the manufacturing sector. And it wasn't simply the phenomenon of increasing unionization and inexpensive manufacturing elsewhere. There's a study by a couple of economists, one of them at the Federal Reserve now, and one Bob Inman at the University of Pennsylvania, that suggested the city's sharp and rising income tax rates in the 70s that helped prompt that. So there's all sorts of suggestions of what policy might be, but I think it's clear, regardless of who the governor has been or the mayor in the last 10 years, in the last 20 years, that there's something about our mix of policies here is just not right. It's not good enough, or it's not doing enough to redress this imbalance.
EJ, your center's, I think it's fair to say, biggest policy agenda tends to be for lower state and local taxes to improve the business climate. Did you release this study as a way to reinforce that argument?
Well, I think that the main purpose in releasing the study is to keep the discussion going, because I do think that I don't think anybody would disagree that if you want to make a judgment on whether the state in general has been successful, that there's probably no better barometer than the migration data. And definitely, as Sam observed, you got to pry into the data a bit more also to see what the nature is of the movements and who's moving where and how it shifts over decades. But certainly we want to feed the debate and inform people. We have certain, I have certain policy preferences that I write about, and other people at Manhattan Institute do. But, reasonable people can disagree on that. But I do think that this is something that we need to confront.
Sam, what other policy questions? I mean, some of it is just the naturally occurring everythingness of New York that both draws people and repels people. But at a policy level, in addition to the tax debate, no matter which side anybody comes down on it, what else do you think on a policy level we need to look at in terms of maximizing in-migration and minimizing out-migration, if that's a goal?
Well, I think there are two things that affect the results, particularly in the past 10 years. When you look at the immigration from abroad, you see a slight decline over the 1990s in particular, and there are two reasons for that. I think one is the aftermath of 9/11. The other is the recession. Another factor, interestingly enough, is that the loss in domestic migration, the net loss, might even have been higher, except that the recession was so widespread that it meant people couldn't find jobs anywhere else as well as in New York, and also probably some people who might have been inclined to move from New York were stuck here because they couldn't sell their houses or might have sold them at a loss. I think one of the things, the economic situation is a big factor in why people come here. As EJ says, certainly jobs are always a very big factor, as well as the cost of raising a family, and crime, which has certainly gone down and made the city a much more attractive place for many people to live.
Listeners, we're talking to Sam Roberts from the New York Times, EJ McMahon from the Manhattan Institute, about census figures over the last 10 years and over the last 50 years regarding who's coming, who's going from New York State. Tell us your story of coming and going in the last 10 years. If you migrated here since 2000, call up and tell us why, whether it's from Lima or Ohio or Lima, Peru, 212-433-WNYC. If you are a domestic or foreign immigrant to New York State, 212-433-9692. And if you're preparing to move out, or if you already moved to another state in the last 10 years, and maybe you're listening to us from New Jersey or Connecticut, or maybe you're listening to us on the web from Nevada or wherever, call us and tell us your story. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Regina in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Regina.
Hi. Wow, I got through. I'm a domestic, migrator who has decided, okay, enough. I've been here for 2 years, and that's it. I'm gone. I'm leaving after Labor Day.
Why? Why'd you come? And where are you going?
I'm originally from L.A. Then I moved to San Francisco for law school, and I just always had it in my head that I wanted to live in New York. So after I moved back from living abroad in South Korea, I decided, okay, go, just go. And I did, and I've been here for 2 years. I started a business, and it's going well, but I just find that people compromise on way too much to just have kind of a certain level of living here. And
comfort, compromise on what?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Compromise on what? Space?
Well,
or?
Honestly, like in the apartment that I'm in right now, you know, I'm moving out and I'm dealing with rats. And I've never, you know, prior to living in New York, I never, you know, had rodents in my apartment.
Right.
And, you know, but also the rent's not that expensive. So you can't really push back that hard on the landlord because they know that someone else will move in.
Regina, thank you very much. EJ, there's your next study, the Rat Migration Index.
I've made a note of that.
James in Queens, you're on WNYC. Coming or going?
I'm going, Brian. You know, when you look at what's going on in this city for the past 9-10 years, taxes, fees, your sewer rate, your water rate, everything is going up. And there's no room. I remember when the formula was 1 week's pay for rent. Now it's 3 weeks. And it's, you know, people just can't make it. I have two daughters graduated from college. My wife and I, we send them there. They're coming out student loan free. But they don't have a job, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just ridiculous.
So public and private sector expenses. How long have you been here?
I've been here 37 years.
Wow. And where are you going?
Excuse me?
Where are you going?
I'm going to South Carolina or Costa Rica.
How'd you choose South Carolina or Costa Rica?
That's correct.
Why those two? If you stay in this country, why South Carolina?
South Carolina, the cost of living down there, it's less than New York, and they're more for your money. You can get a bigger house, you know, for less. And, you know, the quality of life is different.
Thank you very much. Sam Roberts, people always talk about retiring to Costa Rica. I have a cousin who retired to Belize not that long ago, and I guess some people actually do it.
I guess they do, although I have to say, not that I'm thinking of it yet. I can't think of a better place to retire than to New York, where you've got lots of services around, lots of things to do. What you're finding now is a beginning of a migration back from places like Florida of particularly elderly people, more elderly, the older old, because they want to be closer to family, to medical services, to transportation services. So you're seeing a little bit of that reverse migration, too, among retirees.
But maybe you've got to be affluent enough.
Yes, you do. That is absolutely true. Well, you've got to be able to afford it, either be able to retire in place because you own an apartment or own a home, and that clearly makes it a lot easier.
And maybe somebody like James in Queens, of course, I don't know his actual housing situation, maybe he can sell his $500,000 co-op here and buy a $150,000 house in Costa Rica and there he goes with retirement lifestyle. Keith in Red Bank, you're on WNYC. Hi, Keith.
Yeah, I had just a couple of things that I thought maybe the commenters could, like, give some more color on. You know, I noticed an article in the New York Times not too long ago about sort of a reverse of the great African-American migration in the 1930s. A lot of blacks in the middle class are moving back, you know, down south. And then also, I remember reading within the last couple of years here that something like 30% of the apartments on Manhattan are actually owned by foreigners who don't live in them. You know, they kind of buy them as hedges against political instability. And so I'm wondering how much, you know, it sort of echoes what the previous caller said, you know, with affordability and so forth. I mean, I remember the 1970s in New York when, you know, it was cheap and, you know, CBGB's is now a T-shirt shop. And, you know, back in the 70s, you go walk across Times Square, you know, and you get like four offers of female companionship. The city was a little dirtier, but it was a lot more affordable. I mean, like, I wonder if Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe could get a start today.
Keith, thank you very much. Well, E.J. McMahon, what do you think about the affordability question? I mean, people could argue that, it's not on Second Avenue where CBGB's was, but, you know, if you go to Morrisania in the Bronx or wherever, you can still find that rent and start affording to live here.
Well, I think affordability is a huge issue on both sides of the equations, no doubt about it. And I think that it's also part of the churn and flow that Sam talked of. In other words, if you are a low-skill worker just arrived from overseas, say, as an immigrant, you can find it more affordable, say, to live in Mauritania and to have a service job in Manhattan. If you do better, you get educated, you get a better job, and you have aspirations to own your own home, that's when you begin to look somewhere else. Because actually, once you enter what's normally considered the middle class in New York, the more expensive or unaffordable New York gets, I would say.
Dan, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think that's a common experience a lot of people have. It's an incredibly expensive place. I mean, let's face it, there are some places that are relative bargain by New York standards. And we should note, though, that all over New York State, from Montauk all the way to Niagara Falls, is more expensive in terms of its cost of living than comparable places elsewhere in the country.
Don in Portland, or Dan, I'm sorry, in Portland, Maine. You're on WNYC. Hi, Dan.
Hey there, Brian. How are you?
Good. Did you move to New York?
Well, no. Actually, I'm a lifelong New York State. I was a New York State resident, and then in New York City for the last 13 years.
Uh-huh.
And then last November, my girlfriend and I moved to Portland, Maine on a whim. We went on vacation in Maine in the summer and decided we needed a new place to live and a new experience. And because of all of the stressors that you know you've been talking about, we decided this would be a good place. And now, in about 3 months, we're moving back.
How come?
Well, because to put it very simply, we're city people. Portland has been a really nice respite for a little while, but got 65,000 people, and I think I had 65,000 people on my block in Brooklyn.
You got bored.
Yeah, we got a little bored. We definitely friends, family, but you know, we're still nervous about the stressors and mm-hmm. the financial situation that you guys were just talking about. We're very nervous about that. But we need the city. We need the dynamic part of the city. But we can't move to Brooklyn. We've been priced out of our old neighborhood, so we're looking in Astoria.
Interesting. Dan, good luck. Good luck when you come back. Call us when you're here. And Rick in Queens is going to be our last caller, questioning, I think, the entire premise of this conversation. Right, Rick?
Yes, exactly. I'm wondering why this general consensus that increasing the population of New York City is a good thing. Our subways are crowded. Our schools are overflowing. You know, you walk down some of the streets in Manhattan on a Friday night, you can't even walk down the streets. Why not figure out policies that can reduce the population and make it more kind of bearable for the people who are living here?
Rick, thank you. And E.J. McMahon, it's true. While in the rest of the country they're debating about how to stop the flow of migration, especially from Mexico, here we are, you know, you and Sam, saying we need more people.
Well, the caller kind of brought to mind the Yogi Berra saying the effect that restaurant is so popular nobody goes there anymore. If you want to have a strategy for reducing the population of New York, I suppose you could revisit the 70s when the previous caller pointed out New York City was a lot cheaper and more affordable and also a lot grungier and less safe. Growing population comes with the territory. I wouldn't necessarily agree that all of New York, that there's adequate housing in all of New York, or that New York City's carrying capacity has been reached or exceeded. How it's distributed is another question, but more people does equal and it signals economic growth and dynamism at a level that, you know, it creates attention for sure. But I don't think you prefer the alternative.
Sam, you want to give us a last word on that same question?
Well, I think EJ is absolutely right. What you want is growth, because growth is a sign of prosperity and vibrancy, but you also want smart growth. You want to make sure that infrastructure exists to support that in terms of schools and subways, particularly public transportation and things like that. And that demands public policy, and it also demands a contribution from the public.
The new report from the Empire Center for New York State Policy, part of the Manhattan Institute, is called The Empire State's Half-Century Exodus. It was co-authored by our guest E.J. McMahon. Our other guest has been Sam Roberts, urban affairs correspondent and census and demographics watcher at the New York Times. Thank you both so much for having this discussion.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
And Brian Lehrer on WNYC with a reminder that we're going to kind of follow up on this next hour and have a call in for immigrants from anywhere, and that means anywhere in the world, including anywhere in the United States, on what your hometown or home country media is talking about. We've been so overwhelmed with news about the debt ceiling debate in this country, a lot of other things have gotten lost. And we do this from time to time anyway. So coming up in about an hour from now, we're going to have a call in from immigrants from anywhere. And that means if you come from Lima, Ohio, or if you come from Lima, Peru, or India, or China, or Europe, or Kansas, or you name it, we want you in the next hour to go check the website of your hometown media and see what the headlines are. And then call us up in about an hour and tell us what the place you came from is talking about in their media today. Okay, will you participate in this? This is only going to work if you do it. So we want you, if you're an immigrant from anywhere in the country or anywhere in the world to the New York area, go look at what your country of origin or city or town of origin media is doing today. Go look at their website and then get ready to call in with it, the news from anywhere and everywhere, in about an hour from now. Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up right now. After this break, we will look at another New York City issue, a related issue in a way, with a housing shortage chronic around here. Why the city of New York, it looks like, is going to put private housing in a public park in Brooklyn. Stay with us.